Chapter 8. Mengeta. All men are greater than dead men. A Nanai proverb. Every monumental work of the state is measured by cubits. Every cubit is measured by the length of the Aspect Emperor's arm. And the Aspect Emperor's arm, they say, stands beyond measure. But I say the Aspect Emperor's arm is measured by the length of a cubit, and that all cubits are measured by the works of the state. Not even the all stands beyond measure, for it is more than what lies within it, and more is a kind of measure. Even the god has his cubits. Imparas, Sukalogs. Early summer, 4111, year of the Tusk, the plains of Mengeta.
They celebrate my uncle's honor, Earl Athgieri said as he led Kellis through carousing mobs of drunk Northmen. The Galeoth preferred leather wedge tents with heavy wooden frames adorned by tusks and crude animal totems. Without the need to stake guy ropes, they were able to arrange them board to board, canvas to canvas, in large circular enclosures about a central fire. Athgieri led him through enclosure after enclosure, prompted by Kellis's questions to explain the various peculiarities of his people's appearance, customs, and traditions. Though annoyed at first, the young earl was soon beaming with wonder and pride, struck not only by the distinctiveness and nobility of his people, but by a new self-understanding as well. Like so many men, he'd never truly considered who or what he was. Coithus Athgieri, Kellis knew, would never forget this walk. At once so easy and so difficult. Kellis had taken the shortest path. He'd acquired crucial background knowledge concerning Sauban's heritage, and he'd gained the confidence and admiration of his precocious nephew, who hence would look on Prince Kellis of Atrathau as a friend, and more as someone who made him wiser, better than he was with other men. Eventually, they shouldered their way into an enclosure far larger and far drunker than any of the others. On the far side, Kellis glimpsed the red lion banner of House Coithus rising above the shadowy congregation. Athgieri began pushing his way toward it, cursing and berating his countrymen. But he paused when they neared the enclosure's center, where a bonfire whisked sparks and smoke into the night sky.
"This will interest you," he said, grinning.
A large clearing had been opened before the fire, and two Galeoth, breathless and stripped to the waist, stood facing each other in its heart, holding what appeared to be two staffs between them. Each, Kellis realized, had their wrists bound by leather straps to the end of each pole, so they were held from each other. Gripping the polished wood, they leaned each against the other, their white chests and sunburned arms taut with veins and straining muscle. The onlookers hooped and roared. Suddenly, the nearer man pulled rather than pushed with his left, and his opponent stumbled forward. Then the two men fairly danced around the fire, heaving, yanking, shoving, thrusting, whatever it took to bring their opponent to the packed earth. The larger man staggered, and for a moment looked as though he might lurch into the fire. The crowd gasped, then cheered as he caught himself just short of the fiery column. With a roar, he jerked the smaller man into his long shadow, then drove him back, only to suddenly falter, shaking his head fiercely. A small flame puffed from his cropped mane, at the sight of which literally dozens doubled over with laughter. The man cried out, cursed. For an instant, it appeared he might panic, but someone sent what looked like beer or mead slapping across his scalp. More booming laughter, punctuated by cries of foul. Athgieri chortled, turned to Kellis.
"These two really hate each other," he called over the ruckus. "They want blood, or burns more than silver."
"What is this?"
"We call it Gandoki, or shadows. To beat your Gandok, your shadow, you must knock him to the ground."
His laugh was relaxed and infectious, the laugh of a man utterly certain of his place among others.
"The Picts," he added, using the common derogatory term for non-Norserai. "They think we Galeoth are a race without subtlety, and so women say of men, but Gandoki proves that it's not entirely true."
Then suddenly, as though stepping through a door from nowhere, Sarcellus stood between them,
wearing the same white and gold vestments as at the amphitheater.
Prince, he said, bowing his head to Kellis.
Athgieri fairly whirled. What are you doing here? The Shrial Knight laughed, fixing the Earl with large camel-lashed eyes.
The same as you, I suppose.
I wished to confer with Prince Kellis. You followed us, Athgieri said.
Please,
the thing replied, pretending to be offended. I knew I'd find him here,
enjoying the largesse.
He looked skeptically at the surrounding crowds. Of the battle celebrant. Athgieri glanced at Kellis, his look, his heart rate, even the draw of his breath, striking a note of scarcely concealed aversion. He thought Sarcellus vain and effete, Kellis realized, a particularly repellent member of a species he'd long ago learned to despise. But then that was likely what the original Cutius Sarcellus had been, a pompous caste noble. Sarcellus, the real Sarcellus, was dead. What stood here in his stead was a beast of some kind, an exquisitely trained animal. It had wrenched Sarcellus from his place and had assumed all he once was. It had robbed him even of his death. No murder could be more total.
Well then, the young Earl said, looking off as though distracted.
Allow me a few words with the Knight Commander, Kellis said.
Though he scowled as he spoke, Athgieri agreed to meet him at Sauban's tent in a short time.
Run along,
Sarcellus said, as the Earl impatiently shoved his way among his shouting kinsmen. A keening shriek pealed through the air. Kellis saw the larger Gandaki player stumble and fall beneath the fists of several Galioth who'd broken from the crowd. But the screaming came from his smaller opponent. Kellis glimpsed the man between shadowy legs, blistered from the fire, smoking coals still embedded in his right shoulder and arm. Others came rushing to the larger man's defense. A knife flashed, blood slopped across the packed ground. Kellis glanced at Sarcellus, who stood rigid, utterly absorbed by the mayhem unfolding before them. Pupils dilated, arrested breath, quickened pulse. It possesses involuntary responses. Its right hand, Kellis noted, lingered near his groin, as though straining against some overpowering masturbatory compulsion. Its thumb stroked its forefinger. Another cry rang out. The thing called Sarcellus fairly trembled with ardor. These things hungered, Kellis realized. They ached. Of all the rude animal impulses that coerced and battered the intellect, none possessed the subtlety or profundity of carnal lust. In some measure, it tinctured nearly every thought, impelled nearly every act. This was what made Serwe so invaluable. Without realizing, every man at Zynemus's fire, with the exception of the Skilvendi, knew they best wooed her by pandering to Kellis, and they could do naught but woo her. But Sarcellus, it was clear, ached for a different species of congress, one involving suffering and violence. Like the Srank, these skin spies continually yearned to rut with their knives. They shared the same maker, one who had harnessed the venal beast within their slaves, sharpened it as one might a spear point. The consult.
Galioth, Sarcellus remarked with an offhand grin,
are forever cutting their own throats, forever culling their own herd. The brawl had been cut short by the ranting of Earl Anferig. Carried hanging from arms and legs, three bloodied men were being hurried from the fire. They strive, Kellis said, quoting Inri Sejanus, for they know not what. So they cry villainy and claim others stand in their way. Somehow the consult knew he'd been instrumental to the Emperor's discovery of Skaeus. The question was whether his role had been incidental or otherwise. If they suspected he could somehow see their skin spies, they would be forced to balance the immediate threat of exposure against the need to know how he could see them. I must walk the line between, make myself a mystery they must solve. Kellis stared at the thing for a bold moment. When it feigned a scowl, he said, No, please indulge me. There's something about you, about your face.
Is that why you watched me so in the amphitheater?
For a heartbeat, Kellis opened himself to the Legion within. He needed more information. He needed to know, which meant he needed a weakness, a vulnerability. This Sarcellus is new. Was I that indiscreet? Kella said. I apologize. I was thinking of what you said to me that night in the Unaris at the ruined shrine. You made quite an impression.
And what did I say?
It acknowledges its ignorance as any man would, any man with nothing to hide. These things are well trained.
You don't recall?
The impostor shrugged.
I say many things.
With a smirk, it added, I have a beautiful voice.
Kella simulated a frown.
Are you playing with me, playing some kind of game?
The counterfeit face clenched into a scowl.
I assure you I'm not.
Just what did I say?
That something had happened. Kellis began apprehensively. That the endless hunger, I think you said. Something like a twitch, too faint for world-born eyes, flickered across its expression.
Yes, Kellis continued. The endless hunger. What about it?
A near imperceptible tightening of pitch, quickening of cadence. You told me you weren't what you seemed. You told me you weren't a Shrile Knight. Another twitch, like a spider answering a shiver through its silk. These things can be read.
You deny this? Kellis pressed.
Are you telling me you don't remember?
The face had become as impassive as a palm.
What else did I say?
It's confused, uncertain as to what to do.
Things I could scarcely credit at the time. You said you'd been assigned to coordinate observation of the Mandate Schoolman, and to that end you'd seduced his lover Esmanette. You said that I was in great danger, that your masters thought I had some hand in some disaster in the Emperor's court. You said that you were prepared to help.
The creases and wrinkles of its expression jerked into a network of hairline cracks as though sucking humid night air.
Did I tell you why I confessed all this?
Because you'd hungered for it, too.
But what's this? You really don't remember, do you?
I remember.
Then what is this? Why have you become so coy? You seem different.
Perhaps I've reconsidered.
So much. In the span of moments, Kellis had confirmed his hypotheses regarding the consult's immediate interests, and he'd uncovered the rudiments of what he needed to read these creatures. But most important, he'd sown the threat of betrayal. How could Kellis possibly know what he knew, they would ask, unless the original Sarcellus had actually told him? Whatever their ends, the consult depended through and through upon total secrecy. One defection could undo everything. If they feared for the reliability of their field agents, these skin spies, they would be forced to restrict their autonomy and to proceed with more caution. In other words, they would be forced to yield the one commodity Kellis required more than any other. Time. Time to dominate this holy war. Time to find an Asarimber Moengus. He was one of the conditioned, Dunyane, and he followed the shortest path, the Logos. The surrounding crowds had settled into rumbling conversations, and both Kellis and Sarcellus looked to the bonfire. A towering Gaisendalman, his hair bound into a war knot, raised the Gandaki sticks high against the night sky, crying out for more challengers. Laughing, the thing called Sarcellus seized Kellis by the forearm and pulled him into the raucous circle. The crowd began thundering anew. It believed me. Did it improvise? Was it acting out of panic? Or was this its intent all along? There was no question of refusing the challenge, not in the company of warlike men. The resulting loss of face would be crippling. Washed by the heat of the bonfire, they stripped. Kellis to the linen kilt he wore beneath his blue silk cassock, Sarcellus to nothing, in the fashion of Nansur athletes. The Galioth howled in ridicule, but the thing called Sarcellus seemed oblivious. They stood a length apart, appraising each other while two Agmundermen bound their wrists to the poles. The Gaisendalman jerked each pole to ensure it was secure. Then, without a glance at either of them, he cried,
Gandalf!
Shadow. Bare skin, yellow in the firelight, they circled each other, lightly grasping the ends of their poles. Though still roaring, the crowds trailed into silence, fell away altogether, until there was only one figure, Sarcellus, occupying one place, Kellis. Sheets of muscle flexing beneath fire-shining skin, many anchored and connected in inhuman ways.
dilated eyes watching, studying from a knuckled face, steady pulse, tumid phallus hardening, a mouth made of gracile fingers moving, speaking.
We are old, Anasarimba. Very, very old. Age is power in this world.
He was bound to a beast, Kellis realized, to something, according to a Kamian, begot in the bowels of Golgotharoth, an abomination of the old science, the Techne. Possibilities bloomed, like branches twining through the open air of the improbable.
Very many, it hissed, have thought to play the game you now play.
Losing was the simplest solution, but weakness incited contempt, invited aggression.
We've had 1,000,000 foes through the millennia, and we've made shrieking agonies of their hearths, wildernesses of their nations, mantles of their skins.
But defeating this creature could render Kellis too much a threat.
All of them, Anasarimba, and you are no different.
He must strike some kind of balance. But how? Kellis thrust with his right, heaved with his left, tried to draw Sarcellus off balance. Nothing. It was as though the poles had been harnessed to a bull, preternatural reflexes, and strong, very strong. Strategies revised, alternatives revisited. The thing called Sarcellus grinned, his phallus now curved like a bow against his belly. To be aroused by battle or competition, Kellis knew, occasioned great honor among the Nansur. How strong is it? Kellis leaned into the poles, elbows back, as though holding a wheelbarrow, and pushed. Sarcellus adopted the same stance, muscles strained, knotted, gleaming as though oiled. The ash poles creaked.
Who are you? Kellis cried under his breath.
Sarcellus grunted, its fists shaking, sinking to its waist. Then it yanked. Kellis skidded forward. The instant of his imbalance, it jerked around as though throwing a discus. Kellis caught himself, heaved back on both poles. Then they were dancing around the clearing, jerking and thrusting, matching move with countermove, each the perfect shadow of the other. Between heartbeats, Kellis tracked the shift and sway of its center of balance, an abstract point marked by the peak of its erection. He observed repetitions, recognized patterns, tested anticipations, all the while analyzing the possibilities of the game, the manifold lines of move and consequence. He restricted himself to an elegant yet limited repertoire of moves, luring it into habits, reflexive responses.
What do you want? He cried.
Then he improvised. From a near crouch, he kicked down on the left pole while throwing up his left arm and punching out with his right. Its right hand slammed to the earth, Sarcellus doubled forward and was thrown back. For an instant, it resembled a man bound to a falling boulder. It kicked free of the ground, trying to somersault back to its feet. Kellis yanked the poles backward, tried to slam it onto its stomach. Somehow, it managed to pull its left leg, knee to chest, underneath in time. Its right foot scooped into the fire. A shower of ash and coals went streaming into the air, not to blind Kellis, but to obscure the two of them, he realized, from the watching Galioth. It jerked both arms back and out, thrust itself forward between the poles, kicked. Kellis blocked with his own shin and ankle, once, twice.
It means to kill me.
An unfortunate accident while playing a barbaric Galioth game. Kellis jerked his arms inward and across, caught the thing's third kick with the bisecting poles. For a heartbeat, he held the advantage in balance. He thrust it backward, heaved it nude into the golden flames.
Perhaps if I injure...
Then yanked it forward. A mistake. Unharmed, Sarcellus landed running, barreled Kellis backward with inhuman strength, slammed him into the packed Galioth masses, bowling men over and forcing others to scramble clear. Once, twice, Kellis almost fell, then his back slammed against something heavy, a tent frame. It collapsed with a crack, and the wedge tent went down, under, and they were in the darkness beyond the enclosure, where the thing, Kellis realized, hoped to kill.
This must end.
His feet caught hard earth. Bracing his legs, grasping the poles, he dipped and wrenched upward, wheeling Sarcellus high into the night air. The thing's astonishment lasted only a heartbeat, and it managed to crack one of the poles with a kick. Kellis slapped it to the ground like a flag.
The place became a man, slick with perspiration, breathing deep. The first of the Galioth sprinted over the demolished tent, calling for torches, stumbling in the sudden darkness. They saw Sarcellus pressing himself to his hands and knees at Kellis's feet. As astounded as they were, they bawled out Kellis's name, acclaiming him victor.
"What have I done, father?"
As they unbound his wrists, slapping him on the back and swearing they'd never seen the like, Kellis could only watch Sarcellus, who slowly pulled himself to his feet. Bones should have been broken. But then, Kellis now knew, it was a thing without bones, a thing of cartilage, like a shark. Sauban watched Athgieri stare in horror at the bones scattered across the earthen floor. The tent was small, far smaller than the garish pavilions used by the other great names. Beneath the blue and red-dyed canvas, there was room enough only for a beaten field cot and a small camp table where the Galioth prince sat, so very deep into his cups. Outside, the revelers howled and laughed, the fools.
"But he's here, uncle," the young Earl of Gainry said. "He waits."
"Send him away,"
Sauban cried. He loved his nephew dearly, couldn't look at him without seeing his beloved sister's beautiful face. She'd protected him from Papa. She'd loved him before she died. But had she known him? Kusalt knew.
"But uncle, you asked."
"I care not what I asked."
"I don't understand. What's happened to you?"
"To be known by one man and to be hated." Sauban leapt from his seat, seized his nephew about the shoulders, cowed him the way only one of Er Yeet's sons could. How he wanted to cry out the truth, to confess everything to this boy, this man with his sister's eyes, his sister's blood. But he wasn't her. He didn't know him, and he would despise him if he did.
I cannot have him see me like this, can't you see?
No one must know. No one.
Like what?
This!
Sauban bawled, thrusting the young man back. Athgieri caught his balance and stood dumbstruck, openly hurt. He should have been outraged, Sauban thought. He was the Earl of Gainry, one of the most powerful men in Galioth. He should have been infuriated, not appalled. Kusalt's forever murmuring lips.
"I would have you know how much I hate."
"Just send him away,"
Sauban cried.
"As you wish,"
his nephew murmured. Glancing once again at the bones prodding through the earth, he withdrew through the leather flaps. Bones, like so many little tusks.
No one, not even him.
Though it was late, sleep was out of the question. It seemed to Eleazarus that he'd been asleep for weeks now that High Aenon and the Scarlet Spires had finally rejoined the Holy War. For what was sleep if not unconsciousness of the greater world, a profound ignorance? To remedy this, Eleazarus had set Iacchus, his master of spies, to work the instant their palanquins had set ground on the plains of Mengeta. The battlefield of 5 days previous needed to be surveyed and witnesses interviewed to determine what tactics the Kishorim had used and how the Enrithi had bested them. The various informants and spies they'd placed throughout the Holy War also had to be contacted and questioned, both to ascertain how things stood in general, now that they marched through heathen territory, and to pursue the matter of these new Kishorim spies. Faceless spies. Spies without the mark. He awaited Iacchus outside his pavilion, pacing by torchlight, while his secretaries and Javra bodyguards watched from a discreet distance. After spending weeks entombed in his palanquin, he found himself despising enclosed spaces. Everything seemed to bind and constrict these days. After a time, Iacchus emerged from the darkness, a ghoul in flashing crimson.
"Walk with me," he said to the Canv addict.
"Through the encampment?"
"You fear riots?"
the Grand Master asked somewhat incredulously.
"After losing so many to the Kisharim, I'd assume they'd appreciate a few blasphemers in their midst."
"No, I thought we might visit the ruins instead. They say Mengeda is older than Shir."
"Ah, Iacchus the antiquarian," Eleazarus laughed. "I keep forgetting."
Though he personally had no interest in seeing the ruins, he thought antiquarianism a defect of character proper to mandate schoolmen, he felt curiously indulgent. Besides,
The dead made for good company, he supposed, when planning one's very survival. Instructing his bodyguards to remain behind, he strolled with Iacchus into the darkness.
So what did you find? He asked.
After we illuminated the fields, Iacchus said, things fell into place.
Caught from the side by passing torchlight, his pigment-deprived eyes seemed to glow a momentary red.
Most unsettling, seeing the work of sorcery without the mark. I had forgotten.
One more reason for this outrageous risk, Iacchus, to stamp out the Suka.
A sorcery they couldn't see, a metaphysics they couldn't comprehend. What more did they need?
Indeed, the linen-skinned man replied unconvincingly. What we know is this. According to every report, Galioth and non-Galioth, Prince Sobon single-handedly repulsed the Padiraja's Koyari.
Impressive, Eleazarus said.
As impressive as it is unlikely,
the ever-skeptical master of spies said.
But the point is moot. What matters is that the Phanum were then chased by the Shrial Knights. That, I think, was the decisive factor.
How so?
The scorched turf corresponding to Gotian's charge doesn't begin at Sorbonne's lines along the ravine, where one might expect, but rather some 70 paces out. I think the Koyari, as they fled, actually screened the Shrial Knights from the Kishorum. They were only 100 or so paces away when the Sukari began scourging them.
It was the scourge they used then.
Iacchus nodded.
I would say so, and perhaps the lash as well.
So they were secondaries or tertiaries?
Without question, the master of spies replied.
Perhaps under one or two primaries. It's a pity we didn't have the foresight to post observers among the Norserai. Aside from what you and I witnessed 10 years ago, we know next to nothing about their concerts. And unfortunately, no one seems to know just who any of them were. Not even the higher-ranking Kianin captives.
Eleazarus nodded.
It would be nice to know who. Even still, a dozen of them dead, Iacchus. A dozen.
The schoolmen of the Three Seas were called the Few for good reason. The Kisharim, according to their informants in Shaima and Nensophon, could field at most 100 to 120 ranking Sukari, very near the number of sorcerers of rank the Scarlet Spires itself could field. When one counted in thousands, the loss of 12 scarcely seemed significant, and Eleazarus had no doubt that many in the Holy War, among the Shrial Knights in particular, gnashed their teeth at the thought of how many they had lost for the sake of so few. But when one counted, as schoolmen did, in tens, the loss of 12 was nothing short of catastrophic or glorious.
An astounding victory, Iacchus said.
He gestured to the men of the Tusk passing them in shadowy clots. Spectators, Eleazarus imagined, returning from the council of great and lesser names.
And from what I gather, the men of the Tusk have only the dimmest notion.
So much the better, Eleazarus thought.
Strange the way cruelty and jubilation could strike such sweet chords.
This, he said with an air of declaration, will be our strategy then. We conserve ourselves at all costs. Allow these dogs to continue killing as many Kisharim as they can.
He paused to secure Iacchus's gaze.
We must save ourselves for Shaima.
How many times had he, Iacchus, and the others debated this issue? Despite the sometimes unfathomable power of the Suka, it remained, they all agreed, inferior to the Anagogus. The Scarlet Spires would win an open confrontation with the Kisharim, there was no doubt. But how many of them would die? What power would the Scarlet Spires wield after destroying the Kisharim? A triumph which saw them reduced to the status of a minor school wouldn't be a triumph at all. They must do more than defeat the Kisharim. They must obliterate them. No matter how lunatic his thirst for vengeance, Eleazarus would not gut his school.
A wise course, Grandmaster, Iacchus said. Yet I fear the Inrithi won't fare so well in a second encounter.
And why is that?
The Kisharim walked, probably to conceal themselves from Sorbonne's Koray, bowmen and crossbowmen, whom he'd positioned too far behind his forward ranks. The strange thing, however, is that they approached without a cavalry escort.
They walked in the open? But I thought striking from opening waves of horsemen was their traditional tactic.
So the Emperor specialists claimed.
Arrogance, Eleazarus said. Whenever they engaged the Nansur,
They faced the Imperial Sake. This time, they knew we were days away, still crossing the Southron gates.
So they waived precautions because they thought themselves invincible.
Iacchus looked down as though watching his sandaled feet and bruised toenails peep from the hem of his shining gown.
Possible, he finally said. Their intent seems to have been to decimate the Enrithi center, nothing more, to ensure it would collapse in the next assault. They probably thought themselves cautious.
They'd walked beyond the campfires and embroidered round tents of their Ainani countrymen to the perimeter of Los Mengeta. The ground sloped upward, breached by broad stone foundations, the remnants of some ancient wall, Eleazarus realized. Taking care not to soil their gowns, they gained the stony summit. Around them stretched a great swath of debris fields, truncated walls, and on the skyline, an ancient acropolis crowned by a gallery of Cyclopean pillars, standing desolate beneath the constellation of Ouroras.
Something broke the back of this place, Eleazarus thought. Something breaks the back of every place.
What news of Drusus Acamion?
He asked. For some reason, he felt breathless. The canv addict stared into the night, lost in another of his annoying reveries. Who knew what happened in that spidery and methodical soul? Finally, he said,
I fear you may be right about him.
You fear?
Eleazarus fairly snapped.
You concluded the interrogation of Scalatius yourself. You know what happened that night beneath the Emperor's palace better than anyone, save the principals, perhaps. The Abomination recognized Acamion. Ergo, Acamion is somehow connected to the Abomination. The Abomination could only be a Kisharum spy. Ergo, Acamion is connected to the Kisharum.
Iacchus turned to him, his face as mild as milk.
But is the connection significant?
That is the very question we must answer.
Indeed. And how do you propose we answer it?
How else? By seizing him, by interrogating him.
Did he think the menace of these changelings didn't warrant such extreme measures? Eleazarus couldn't imagine any greater threat.
Just like Scalatius?
Eleazarus thought of the shallow grave they had left in Anserca, suppressed an uncharacteristic shudder.
Just like Scalatius.
And that, Iacchus said, is precisely what I fear.
Suddenly, Eleazarus understood.
You think, he said, that it would be useless to ply him.
Over the centuries, the Scarlet Spires had abducted dozens of Mandate schoolmen, hoping to wrest from them the secrets of the Gnosis, the sorcery of the ancient North. Not one of them had succumbed, not one.
I think plying him for the Gnosis would be useless, Iacchus said. What I fear is that even under torment or the compulsions, he'll simply insist the Abomination that replaced Skaos was a consult and not a Kisharum.
But we already know, Eleazarus cried, that the man plays a tune far different from the one he sings. Think of Geshruni. Drusus Acamion cut off his face, and then, a little over a year later, he's recognized by a faceless spy in the Emperor's dungeons? This is no mere coincidence.
Eleazarus glared at the man, clutched his shaking hands. He did not, he decided, like the reptilian way, Iacchus listened.
I know these arguments, Iacchus said.
He turned to once again scrutinize the moonlit ruins, his expression translucent and unreadable.
I simply fear there's more to this.
There's always more, Iacchus. Why else would men murder men?
Esmonette had tried, many times since her daughter's death, to attend to the void within her. She tried questioning it away, by asking the priests she bedded, but they always said the same thing, that the god dwelt only in temples, and that she'd made a brothel of her body. Then they would brothel her again. For a time, she tried smearing it away by coupling with men for anything, half coppers, bread, even a rotted onion once. But men could never fill, only muddy. So she turned to others like her, watching, observing. She studied the always laughing whores, who somehow exulted in being guttered day for night, or the chirping slave girls, their faces anchored forward beneath their water urns, smiling and rolling their eyes from side to side. She made their motions her motions, as though certainty were a kind of dance. And for a time she discovered comfort. as though habits of gesture and expression could drum for a deadened heart. For a time, she forgot the distance between a fact and a face. She had never tried to love. If joy in gesture couldn't unseat desolation, then perhaps joy in desperation. For 5 days now, they'd camped together in the hills overlooking the battle plain. Ranging ahead, Akamian had found a small stream, which they'd followed into the stony heights. They climbed into a band of pitch pine, whose massive cones rocked in slow circles in the wind, and found a pool of translucent green. They camped nearby, though the lack of forage for Akamian's mule, Daybreak, forced them to trek for an hour or so every day to gather fodder to supplement his grain. 5 days, joking and brewing tea in the cool mornings, making love to the rush of dry wind through the trees, eating hare and squirrel, snared by Akamian no less, with their rations in the evening, touching each other's faces with wonder in the moonlight, and swimming, floating, the crush of ardent heat in cool waters. How she wished it would never end. Esmanet pulled their sleeping mats from the tent, slapped them one after the other in the wind, then set them across warm rock. They'd pitched their tent across the soft ground beneath an ancient and massive pitch pine, a lone sentinel near the terminus of a broad shelf that terraced the north and eastern faces of the hill. This, she thought, is our place. Without visitors, without ruins, without memories, save for the animal bones they'd found curled beneath the tree when they'd first arrived. She ducked back into the tent, pulled Akamian's worn leather satchel from the corner. It was musty, slick, and damp where it had lain against the grasses. Powdery white mold had crept up the stitching. She carried it out into the sunlight, sitting cross-legged on a soft but prickly carpet of pine needles. She pulled out various sheaves of vellum, and weighting them down with stones, set them out to dry. She found a small doll, human-shaped, wooden, but with a simple silken knob for a head and a small rusty knife for a right hand. Humming an old tune from Sumna, she bounced it around, kicked its wooden legs in a little jig. After laughing at her foolishness, she set it out in the sun as well, crossing its legs and pressing its arms behind its head so that it looked like a daydreaming field slave. What would a Akamian be doing with a doll? Then she pulled out a sheet that had been folded separate from the others. Opening it, she saw a series of brief, vertical scribbles arrayed across it, each joined to one, two, or several others by hastily scratched lines. Even though she couldn't read, she'd yet to meet a woman who could. She somehow knew this sheet was important. She resolved to ask Akamian when he returned. After securing it under an axe-shaped flint, she turned to the stitching, began scratching away the mold with a twig. Akamian emerged from the shadows of the deeper wood a short time afterward, bare to the waist, the firewood in his arms braced against his black-furred belly. He shot her a friendly frown as he walked past, glancing at his doll and papers. She grinned and snorted. She adored seeing him like this, a sorcerer playing woodsman, down to the breeches, no less. Even after all her time traveling with the Holy War, breeches still looked outlandish, barbaric, even curiously erotic. They were illegal in many Nansur cities. "Do you know why the Nilnameshi think cats are more human than monkeys?" he asked, stacking his wood against the trunk of their great pine. "No?" He turned toward her, slapping his palms against his breeches. "Curiosity. They think curiosity is what defines men." He walked up to her, grinning. "It certainly defines you."
"Curiosity has nothing to do with it," she replied, trying to sound cross. "Your bag smells like moldy cheese."
"I always thought that was me."
"You smell like ass."
Akamian laughed, raised devilish brows.
"But I washed my beard."
She tossed pine needles at his face, but the wind tugged them away.
"And what's that for?" she asked, gesturing to the doll. "To lure little girls into your tent?"
He sat next to her on the ground.
"That," he said, "is a Wathi doll. You'd make me throw it away if I told you more."
"I see. And this?"
she continued, lifting the folded sheet.
"What's this?"
His good humor evaporated.
"That's my map."
She held the parchment out between them, waved away a small wasp.
"What's this writing? Names?"
"Individuals and different factions.
everyone with some bearing on the Holy War. The lines mark their interrelationships. See? He said, pointing to a line of vertical script on the center left edge. That says, Mathenet. And below? Inro. Without thinking, she reached out and clutched his knee. What about the top corner here? She said, a little too quickly. The consult. She listened to him recite the names. The Emperor, the Scarlet Spires, the Kishorim, explaining their different intents and how he thought each might be related to the others. He said nothing that she hadn't heard before, but for some reason, it suddenly seemed a powerful thing scratched in ink across this cured animal hide. It suddenly seemed horrifyingly real, a world of implacable forces, hidden, violent. Chills pimpled her skin. A Kamian, she realized, didn't belong to her. Not truly. He never could. What was she compared with these mighty things? I can't even read. So why, Akka? She found herself saying. Why have you stopped?
What do you mean?
He stared fixedly at the sheet, as though absorbed. I know what you're supposed to do, Akka. In Sumna, you were constantly out, making inquiries, courting informants. Either that or you were waiting on some news. You were constantly spying. But not anymore. Not since you brought me to your tent.
I thought it was only fair, he said breezily. After all, you gave up.
Don't lie, Akka.
He sighed, and though sitting, assumed the stooping air of slaves who carried onerous burdens. She stared into his eyes, clear, glistening brown, need nervous, sad and wise. As always, when she was this near to him, she yearned to comb her fingers through his beard, to probe the chin and jaw beneath.
How I love you.
It's not you, Esme, he said. It's him. His gaze fell to the name nearest the consult on the parchment sheet, the only one he'd yet to decipher for her. He didn't need to.
Kellis, she said.
They were silent for a time. A sudden gust whisked through the pine, and she glimpsed bits of fluff rolling away, up the granite slope and off into endless sky. For a moment, she feared for the sheaves of parchment, but they were safe beneath their stones, their corners opening and closing like speechless mouths. They'd ceased speaking of Kellis aloud, ever since fleeing the battle plane. Sometimes it seemed an unspoken accord, the kind lovers used to numb shared hurts. Other times it seemed a coincidence of aversions, like avoiding issues of fidelity or sex. But for the most part, it just seemed unnecessary, as though any words they might use had been always already said. For a time, Kellis had been a troubling figure, but he'd soon become intriguing, someone warm, welcoming, and mysterious, a man who promised pleasant surprises. Then at some point, he'd become towering, someone who overshadowed all others, like a noble and indulgent father, or a great king breaking bread with his slaves. And now, even more so in his absence, he'd become a shining figure, a beacon of some kind, something they must follow, if only because all else was so dark.
What is he?
She wanted to say, but looked speechlessly to her lover instead, to her husband. They smiled at each other, shyly, as though just remembering they weren't strangers. They clasped dry, sun-warm hands.
Never have I been so happy.
If only her daughter. Come, Akamian abruptly said, pressing himself to his feet. I want to show you something. She followed him from the matted hummus onto the bare, sun-hot stone. She hissed and scampered to avoid burning her feet, climbing to the rounded ledge. With each step, the vast gray-green sweep of the battle plane rose to brace the skies. Taking Akamian's proffered hand, she joined him on the ledge. She raised a hand to her brow, shielding her eyes from the sun's glare. Then she saw them.
Sweet Sejanus, she whispered.
Like the shadows of truly mountainous clouds, they darkened the plain, great columns of them, their arms winking like powdered diamond in the sunlight. The Holy War marches, Akamian said, rigid with what could only be awe. Breathing hurt, or so it seemed. She glimpsed cohorts of knights, hundreds, even thousands strong, and great files of infantrymen, as long as entire cities. She saw baggage trains, rows of wains no bigger than grains of sand.
and she saw banner after fluttering banner bearing the devices of 1,000 houses, each embroidered with silken tusks.
"So many!"
she exclaimed. What terror the Fena must feel. "More than 250,000 Inwithi warriors," Akamian said. "Or so Zin claims." For some reason, his voice came to her as though from the deeps of some cave. It sounded trapped and hollow. "And as many camp followers, perhaps. No one knows for sure. Thousands upon thousands. With a ponderousness of distant things, they encompassed the nearer reaches of the plain. They moved," she thought, "like wine bleeding through wool. How could so many be bent to one dreadful purpose? One place, one city. Shaima. Is it?" She found herself gasping. "Is it like something from your dreams?" He paused, and though he neither swayed nor stumbled, Esmanette suddenly feared he was about to fall. She reached out, clutched his elbow. "Like my dreams," he said.